The responsive reading for today is number 563. A person will worship something. And I think if we can, this is great being in a church with a center aisle. Ours has two aisles. Nobody can ever figure out how to divide up their responsive readings. But I'm going to ask the people on your right to read, and then your left, to read the alternate paragraphs, starting with those on the right.
A person will worship something. Have no doubt about that. You may think that which dominates our imaginations and our thoughts will determine our lives and character.
Ask you now to take a moment for yourself. Take a moment in silence. Dwell on your own thoughts. And your own meditation. So I'm going to begin my talk today by asking more questions. First question is, what do Mick Jagger, Tracy Chapman, and Steve Gillette have in common? Now, first of all, you may not know who all three of these people are. Mick Jagger, you've got. All three of them are songwriters, but that's not the primary link between them and I'm going to talk about today. The link I'm going to talk about today is that all of them have written songs about the devil or about evil in a way. Mick Jagger, of course, wrote a song called Sympathy for the Devil. And I bet that almost all of you know the first line. Please allow me to introduce myself. I'm a man of wealth and it's a first-person description of the devil and the devil's work on earth. Tracy Chapman wrote, in her first album, wrote a very powerful song about the effect of the devil in our culture in her first album. It was called Mountains of Things. She sings about the hell of the material world and what it represents for those who are born in poverty. Not only the rich exploiting the poor to gain more wealth, but also because the culture that we had taught that the purpose of wealth was to acquire mountains of things, useless trinkets, narcissistic pleasures, and social envy. Steve Gillette, you may know as a songwriter, he sings with his wife, Cindy Manson. They sing many original songs of their own, and he lives here in Vermont. He also gives songwriting workshops to aspiring songwriters and helps those songwriters, those would-be songwriters, cope with the devils that come up that block their songwriting creative process. And this discussion that I'm going to lead today, this talk today, actually comes from a discussion I had with Steve Gillette a couple of years ago. Now, in literature and in history, there are many who have imagined the devil, where the devil is and how it manifests itself. Perhaps the greatest writing about our relationship with the devil is Goethe's Faust. Faust wanted to possess all knowledge. Realizing the impossibility of that as a mere human scholar, he conjures with witches. He becomes dissatisfied then with the witches' magic, which eventually, because he's criticizing the witches, attracts the attention of Mephistopheles, who is the devil's agent. He laments to Mephistopheles about the hollowness and discomfort he feels with the results of the witch's magic. Faust wants some more natural, authentic means to the secrets of perpetual youth and satisfaction. Faust asks Mephistopheles if there is any such way, any such method. Now, an interesting thing you have to understand about Mephistopheles is he never lies. He doesn't need to. Besides, if he did, his victims on the final day of reckoning might claim that they sold their soul under false pretenses. To Faust's question, Mephistopheles replies, "There is a natural way to make you young. Go out in a field and start right into work. Dig, hoe, keep your thoughts and yourself in that field. Eat the food you raise. Be willing to manure the field you harvest. And that's the best way, take it from me, to go on being young to eating." Faust, of course, objects. It says, "Oh, but to live spade in hand, I couldn't do it. I'm not used to it. I couldn't stand it. So narrow a life would not suit me." And Mephistopheles replies, "Well then, we still must have the witch." Faust's sin is not seeking knowledge. His sin is not trusting his uneasiness with the magical ways of obtaining it, and his acceptance of the false solutions, the delusions of the magic. Is there a parallel to Faust's magic in our world? Arthur C. Clarke, the science fiction writer, defined magic. He defined it thusly. Quote, "Any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic." And I would say that any technology we accept without understanding its full impact on our universe could be the magic and could be a delusion promoted by the devils within ourselves. Whether you talk about our use of energy or our system of education, or our present approach to consumption in general, we accept the magic when the present task seems to involve too much labor or is too mundane. Two generations ago, Rachel Carson and several other authors wrote critiques of the direction that the magic called progress was taking us. I reread a number of those articles and found the words of Carson and others to be disturbingly appropriate for today. For example, Wendell Berry, the agrarian writer and poet, sees industrialized agriculture as magic. And I quote him, "For half a century or so, our informal but most effective agricultural policy has been to eat as much, as effortlessly, as thoughtlessly, and as cheaply as we can, and to hell with whatever else may be involved." Ivan Illich, you may not have heard of, he was a scientist, historian, philosopher, and Catholic priest. who served parishes in Central America, in Mexico, before leaving the priesthood to found an educational institute in Mexico. His writings were scathing critiques of First World culture and economics. His strongest objection was not to the greed and injustice, though those were bad enough. His strongest criticism was that our advancing technologies debase our most human characteristics. Our casual acceptance of easy comfort and electromechanical slaves impoverish us by destroying the value of things that we as humans do well, things such as creating images and objects, things such as farming, or walking, or dancing. Our technologies, according to Illich, also guarantee and invalidate injustice. He uses the example of transportation. Show him the speed at which various people in a society travel, and he will show you the structure of the classes in that society. Are there people jetting away on weekends to ski indoors in Dubai? Are there other people walking 3 miles each day to get water? The class structure is pretty evident in these facts. It's kind of a unique tenet of modern culture that neither wealth nor speed acknowledges any upper limits. Konrad Lorenz was first known to me by his book called On Aggression, a book I was so interested in that I read it in college even when it wasn't assigned for a course. In the 70s, Lorenz wrote another book called Civilized Man's Eight Deadly Sins. Those sins are generally what you might expect to hear from one who spent his life studying relationships between and among species. But the reasons he sees civilized life as containing sins, or the sins of civilized life, are perhaps more interesting and more surprising than the sins themselves. He names overpopulation because it promotes alienation and aggressive behavior. He names ecological destruction because it distorts our perspective and our acceptance of our role in the natural world. And he identifies the emphasis in modern life on competition and its accompanying stress because competition commits humanity to a losing race against itself. Lorenz saw nuclear weaponry, as the least of the threats he identified. But he once called the greatest threats, again, this emphasis on competition and the damage it does to our mental and physical health. Damage our science is only now beginning to recognize. He wrote, "Under the pressure of this competitive fury, we have not only forgotten what is useful to humanity as a whole, but even that which is good and advantageous to the individual. One asks, which is more damaging to modern humanity, the thirst for money or our consuming haste? In either case, fear plays a very important role. The fear of being overtaken by one's competitors, the fear of being poor, the fear of making wrong decisions, or just the fear of not feeling up to snuff." Stephen Stoll is another of the authors that I've read. He wrote a book called The Great Delusion, and writes that though the utopians of the 19th century are now generally seen as idealistic dreamers, it is those economists and politicians who believe they can have endless economic global growth who are dreaming. There are economists who see an increasing spiral of consumption and production that is based on a delusional vision of what our planet can provide. Stoll defines what he calls the grandest capitalist conceit of the 20th century, that society forms a part of the economy rather than the other way around. Maybe in the 21st century, we are beginning to acknowledge some of our conceits. Maybe we are beginning to acknowledge our dependence on the magic. Now, I didn't select all these writers because they had the same worldview. They don't particularly. But I was struck by the similarity of some of the underlying human factors that led to their rather negative conclusions. To me, the internal devils that these writers expose are arrogance, denial, and fear. And all of these reside in each of us. And thanks to Steve Gillette, I have found a very powerful tool to expose and confront these devils. The tool is this simple question: what are you trying to do? Steve Gillette sometimes sees these devils in aspiring songwriters and in songwriting workshops. As aspiring songwriters, they all know the mantra of the songwriter or any other creative artist or spiritual seeker for that matter. Be authentic. Let it come from inside. Sing what you know. But sometimes when they get stuck and the song won't come, he looks for signs, and then sometimes he asks them, what are you trying to do in writing this song? What are you trying to do? Are you trying to get rich? Are you trying to attract groupies? Are you trying to prove to your mother you can be a success at this? Are you trying to host Saturday Night Live? Are you trying to get your picture on the cover of the Rolling Stone? Any or all of these might be worthwhile goals, but they certainly will stand in the way of revealing a verse that is authentic to you and your experience. A verse that in turn reveals the truth. It's easy to go through life seeking recognition, seeking acceptance, seeking a foolproof path, always looking outside. That is what Tibetan monk Chogyam Trungpa calls spiritual materialism. Enlightenment, truth, peace, grace, whatever you choose to call it, lies in how we, in our innermost heart of our being, integrate ourselves with the universe around us. The problem, the paradox of seeking truth, is that we need not try to do anything. And it is often the trying itself that stands in our way. Truth is not created, it is revealed. To be human, to seek enlightenment, is to do what we can each day, each hour, not thinking too much about what we have done or what we might yet do. In essence, to give up striving for doing, and then to give up doing for being. To reveal more than to create. To recognize who we are, what place we occupy, and what we are called to do. The plumber and the monk are not that far apart. And of course, each of us doesn't have to strive to be either one. We need to only try to be aware of and listen to that part of ourselves that is the closest connected to the universe, the part that calls us to be whatever we should be. Now, spiritually, this can be a very difficult practice. But think of those you know who manifest what they are. Think of those who struggle, but at the same time, don't strive or grasp. They only live truly for themselves. Those people are the models for our esteem and emulation. If you want to live truly, to paraphrase Gandhi, you must be the model of what you want the world to be. We cannot have a just world if we accommodate or rationalize injustice. We cannot promote understanding if we do not attempt to understand those who disagree with us. We can't change the things we abhor if we cannot accept change ourselves and seek it. Arrogance, denial, and fear. I can confront these internal devils by practicing to use my most human capabilities and to be very careful about which of my most human tasks I want to consign to some technological or political slave. It will help me confront my internal devils to see meeting my needs as an exchange rather than consumption. It will help me confront my internal devils if I sharpen my ability to separate fears from real threats. And I must learn to recognize who I am, a human being first, and with it acknowledge my gifts, my limitations, and my faith. We need to be ourselves and accept ourselves as truly as we can. And so these are my questions for you for the new year. How are you developing your most human characteristics? What magic have you become dependent on? What are you trying, perhaps too hard, to do? I'll give you a few seconds to think about that, and then you can tell me.
I'm going to have to get that, the name of the guy that does the songwriting.
Actually, he has a great book about writing, songwriting, that I would recommend to you, but I'll be happy to write.
I have spent many, many years as an aspiring songwriter, and I have noticed that recently, I have not been able to write a song, and the reason is, strangely enough, happiness. You say, you know, you write what you're trying to convey to the world, and some of the best writing I've ever done was when I was absolutely miserable. Usually because I was in a really bad relationship or I was coming out of a really bad relationship. But Recently, I have gone through something that I really couldn't explain. It was making me very, a lot of turmoil inside. And I called it a midlife crisis. And it allowed me to be able to feel those demons enough to where I was able to start writing again. But unfortunately, there turns out that there was a biological reason for it. I just found out I'm going through menopause. So, you know, that kind of ruined the whole, you know, I was feeling, you know. But, so these days, like within the last 6 or 7 years, since I moved here, actually, and I met my husband, I have been unbelievably happy. But I do have my demons, and I am working on getting them out. I loved your sermon. I was just gripped every second. I loved it. Thank you so much for sharing that.
I have a comment on the word trying. The reason is that I'm retired as a social worker, and we used to talk a lot in groups about try to stand up. You're either sitting, or you're standing, or you're in a squat. It's not a trying. So I don't know exactly where I'm going with this, but that word trying is sort of in limbo. It's a limbo word for me, rather than something. I'm not describing it well, but it's sort of you're contemplating doing something, but you haven't quite gotten up the gumption to do it yet.
Or it's kind of like making up your excuse beforehand.
Yes.
I liked a lot of what you have to say. I'm reacting to the trying, and it's a really good point, because there is that you're either sitting or you're standing. Unless something's going on and you're building the muscles to finish, you can be trying. You can be putting in effort and then fall back down. So I think there can be trying, but I think a lot of people stay in trying and stop trying while they're trying.
A colleague of mine had a sign in her office which said, "Don't tell me what you're going to do, show me what you've done."
On the topic, the devil's in the details, right? You can make a great plan, but sometimes you have to have the right partner to work with. So.
I loved your talk because as a lawyer, the question you asked is one I often ask my clients. I get the answer, "Well, I want to sue so-and-so." And to me, that answer makes about as much sense as, "I want to go drive my car somewhere." So the next question is, well, if I had a magic wand and I could wave it, then what would you want me to do? And often the answer comes back totally perplexed. "I'm not sure."
Thank you so much for the fascinating talk. I was riveted. One part that I liked especially about technology being magic, I'm so glad you talked about that, because it came up for me at Christmas dinner in a conversation with an acquaintance who we were talking about the future of the world and the future of humanity, and he said, "Oh, technology will fix it all." And I did not say out loud, but I thought to myself, it's like he was talking about the second coming. We've had technology all this time. It's not fixing anything. It's just making things worse in many ways. So anyway, you gave me a lot to think about. Thank you.
Um,
listening to what Rebecca just said, this made me think immediately that perhaps an underlying theme or an implied theme of your sermon is, well, what's important? Because I too was really enjoying the things that you had cited, that other writers on this topic had cited as the sins of the modern world, so to speak, and they exemplify in some ways what were concerns of the human race maybe say 200 years ago, you know, and now we're in a different spot, and like the old wants are not, we've like managed to succeed grandly, satisfying those things, but like, you know, our brains and the part of evolution are still back there being chased by saber-toothed tigers, and like, that's not the world we have anymore. So it really, I think one way you should really point out how every so often you have to revise and look at what you're trying, your goals and what you're trying to achieve and what we're trying to achieve as people together. So thank you.
So let's let John finish us up here.
Well, I don't know if this is a good one to go out on. Because I missed most, you know, I just came in late, but I just wanted to say that I was just doing that this morning, you know, on the way in, thinking, what exactly is it do I want? And I was thinking about how overexposure to technology has kind of led to this idea that everything is moving fast around me. And, you know, people do want to move fast. There's this kind of impatience, well, at least in traffic anyway. But, you know, time is what you make of it. In some ways, anyway, and when you sit down and meditate, then there's this one long moment. So I'm trying to look at things on that time scale and forget what I've learned about technology, just because technology, at least in video games and in television and so many things, it's always in such a hurry, and it's nice to think about what. How people thought before all of that was going on.
There are several people. Let's continue over. We're running almost late, so let's continue over coffee hour. Our closing hymn is number 108. My life flows on in endless song.
forest in search of the divine. God lives in all and abides with you, too. As fragrance dwells in a flower or reflection in a mirror, so the divine dwells inside everything. Seek, therefore, in your own heart.
Community or the fire of commitment. These we carry and